Welcome to Business Second Opinion with Carol Sanford, a respected thought leader in the world of business design for growing people in order to grow your business. She always offers a contrarian view on what sacred temples of wisdom, such as the Harvard Business Review, advise. Her approach is based on living systems research and her four decades of practice with Fortune 500 companies and rockstar entrepreneurs. I'm Zach Swartout, and I'm your host. Today, Carol is giving a business second opinion on team and interpersonal conflict. We're going over an article called How to Handle a Disagreement on Your Team by Jean Brett and Stephen B. Goldberg from the July 2017 article in the Harvard Business Review. Welcome, Carol.
Hi, Zach.
So as I was thinking about this article and kind of moving into it, in the organization I'm in, which is in a healthcare setting, there's always talk of conflict and there's always talk of this unit or this group or this team is toxic. And so maybe we can bring in a conflict transformation person or a conflict mediator or something like that. So this is a really relevant topic for me today. So where does this idea of conflict come from? And maybe you can give us a little background on that.
Yeah. Why is there so much talk about it, right?
Exactly.
I remember in my early years working before people discovered they couldn't hire me to facilitate anything, that was the most frequent thing I was asked for. I think that it's a failure of worldview. I mean, I literally think that we have gotten so clear about that everything is like a machine, and if it's not working, and if I'm not getting what I want and you're not getting what you want, there is an escalation in each of our separate minds, and suddenly we have an idea that we are in conflict. And to me, it's very artificial. It means that we actually are not taking enough into account. Now, that's a strange way, but that's how I would define conflict. The inability of two parties, which could be two groups, two individuals, rarely is it a third one, to take into account enough to see where it is that the whole needs to fit together. And because people don't have this capacity to think in a big enough way and to consider enough, like in your case, you get people internal to probably a unit inside the health group. And that unit has conflicts between it. And then you could probably think about two that are one upstream and one downstream from the other, and one's not serving. And so now those two end up with conflict with one another. But if you said, we're in conflict with our customers, people would think that's weird. So the conflict is always the internal view of people with one another, rather than thinking about what they're serving. So in a school, you can have two teachers in conflict, but they almost immediately shift when you think about, well, what would work for the student? So it's that artificial creation of something because of too small a boundary.
Yeah. So, and now as we get into this, so what are you seeing in this article that we need to watch for here around conflict? How might we go about reading this so we kind of don't get trapped or hooked by what's being on offer here?
You know, as you've said to me before, I don't read articles the same way other people do. I don't read them and underline. You see most people reading and underlining for good ideas, then they skip a bunch of stuff and then they underline some more. Most of it, they never go back and look at. But if they did, they would be doing it to take those ideas in. I always look at what's behind them. And in this particular one, the things I would want to caution people for and have people learn to watch for this is how, again, there are some different worldviews that frame how people write, frame how they form these practices. And this particular article was very distressing to me because I felt like it was based on such outdated ideas and things that would be damaging if they were taken and practiced. So one of the worldviews that has some of what's here is that conflict is between two people or two sides, and they have to find a way to make both people happy or both groups happy. And therefore, they work on the assumption of compromise and trade-offs. And that's now built into our language, that there is always going to be a conflict, always going to be something that's either conflicted in your ability to deliver it or between people. And so you've somehow got to compromise and make trade-offs. That's actually not the way living systems work. You don't see trees compromising for soil, bargaining and figuring out how one of them takes a little less and the other one takes a little less, and somehow they all come out happy. So that's one way that this one is written, is from that worldview. The second one is because people begin to realize, And I see less of that in there. They didn't much get off of the first one. But the second way that people would tend to write about conflict is the way Stephen Covey wrote about it in The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, which is look for a win-win, you know, and then a few folks have said, well, a win-win-win idea. But the idea here still is that there are two parties which all need to be made happy. And again, that's not a living system. What I look for and where I see gaps that you're going to hear me describe today, they come from not understanding that human beings inside of a system can be self-managing and they have a role in that living system, but they need to use, well, they need to develop, they aren't ready to use, they need to develop capabilities to be able to see the larger context in which anything that appears to be conflicted is happening. And this requires a lot of capability building and to begin to be able to understand how things relate. Now, let me give you an example of what I mean by that. If I enter a meeting with a group of people and I've been in another group or I've been from home and I had a fight with my spouse or partner and I walk into the group and I'm in a terribly reactive mode, most people don't notice that they bring that reactivity right into the next meeting and people say, what's wrong with you today? Or they may not say it, but they think it. Or I may walk in and I'm feeling like I've got to create more space. Things are being taken away from me and I have my ego on display. And if I bring that into the conversation, I'm going to accelerate trying to get something for myself, or at least prove I'm courageous. And therefore, I will trigger something just from not even being able to see myself. I also could be purposeful, and purposeful means I'm thinking about what we're both trying to serve, what we're all trying to serve, what it is our markets, our customers, our families, you know, in your case, even patients would need. If I can't think about that and be purposeful, then I'm going to be a part of a conflict. So until we can build that capability and know that humans have to be able to see that larger system, but they also have to see themselves and how it is they're activating, carrying it out, then we are not yet in a worldview that gives us completeness enough that we begin to understand that it's really not about a conflict. It's about a system dynamic, and we need to work on the whole.
Okay, got it. So what do you feel like, or what does it seem to be that the authors are advocating for in this piece? What are their premises here?
Oh my gosh. Okay. There's some things that sound so good if you're not used to doing this digging that I do. So first one is that there are two parties. They'll have opposing views that'll seem irreconcilable. And somebody, and they do mean somebody, may need to break the impasse. Now, they point out it'd be great if these people could go off and do it for themselves or they've been trained somehow, but sometimes you have to intervene. So the second premise is that they believe managers of those two people on some occasion may need to shift out of their authoritarian role and move into what they speak of as a mediating role. Now, they acknowledge or they assert that there are times you may need to be authoritarian and say, you win and you lose, or here is a solution that takes care of some of both of you. We got to get back to work. We have customers to serve. We have people inside the organization counting on us. But they're major solution here to how you deal with this, something that's gotten so escalated and so emotional, is the manager builds skill in how to be a mediator. Some of the steps that they talk about going through are part of what kind of sent me over an edge. One is to learn to do the kind of interventions that can first clear the way for a mediation and then have a path to get there. One of the things they suggest is you might go meet with people separately in order to let them vent. You know, so they have all this emotion, they're just distressed, and you let them go on and on and on venting, and with the theory that that would get all of it out of them. It turns out, and there's so much research and has been for decades, that says venting does not clear the path. It reinforces literally physically in the brain the neural networks that hold that to be true. It's like a rut that you're deepening in your brain. So ever allowing or encouraging or supporting people being in a venting process and saying, go on, get it all out. That is not a good idea because it just makes it so much more real. I call it reifying it. The second thing is that the manager should go through kind of a set of steps and things to be able to avoid falling in some pitfalls. Like they give specifics of don't go get a non-neutral setting. Go get one where it feels like it's neutral to everybody. Like don't pick one person's or the other person's or your own kind of setting. If you in the separate conversations, if you go with his method of talking with one at a time to interview them, you have to say things like, I want you to be clear. I'm not wanting you to convince me right now. I'm just needing to understand how you see it. I am not making a decision right here. And the funny thing is, there's the assumption that that will work. When people are in an emotional state, they are rarely in a trusting state. And unless there is some extraordinary capacity this manager has, the odds are they're going to try and tell their story in a way that they're convincing. And if they can't see themselves, if they don't have self-managing capacity, they will be telling and positioning the story in a particular way. So the thought that you could just ask people, go ahead and talk to me and tell me your perspective, then I'll listen to the other person. And somehow now I'm a judge sitting on a bench, and I'll be able to understand this, and then we can come together and I'll have some processes that can allow us to work together. So there are all sorts of cautions and caveats about how this mediator has to work, and even gives them a, I don't know, a 5 or 6 step plan of what to do here, what to do there. And I'm not even going to go through those because I just don't recommend this way of working. I think it's critical that we begin to do something really different, because this process is one where you are creating dependency on a third person. You're doing no capability building for the two people or the two groups, and you're actually reinforcing and deepening some of the worst characteristics of teams working together. I don't know how this article got accepted and published.
So, I mean, if you look at the article, it's a long article and it's very detailed. And he goes into a lot of detail. They both go into a lot of detail about how to approach this. So they're clearly basing this on some myths that they're big believers of. So what are the myths here that they're basing all of these ideas on?
I mean, there are probably, if I sat down and wrote them all out, there'd be 10 or 15 of them. But there are a couple which are, I think, core. One is that third parties can have a neutrality and therefore they can be some miracle worker. I mean, you think about the people in government who become state, really great statesperson, secretary of state, and they're able to go negotiate a peace in some country. We've come to believe that we have to have third parties to make things neutral, that two people cannot build the capability and the skill it would take to be able to see themselves, because there's a piece here that is just missing completely, which is human capacity to be self-managing in regard to my own thoughts and how those are triggering behavior. So that's the biggest myth, that somehow third parties are miracle workers. The second one is that is based on a false premise, but therefore it projects out into a myth, is that we can't actually work on understanding anything that's inside of people. And that's an old John Watson theory, our behavioral psychologist who founded the field of behaviorism by studying rats. And of course, his premise was that if you can't see it, you can't count it, then it can't be considered. Just ignore it. So therefore, because under John Watson, you know, in the early part of the 20th century, we accepted the idea that if you can't see it, you can't work on it. We were left stuck. And these guys are clearly stuck in behavioralism, which, I don't know, 50% or more of people who are working and consulting to corporations are, and obviously writing these articles. And of course, later, the human potential movement said, no, no, we can't actually do introspection, and it's really useful. But that introspection, and the reason it was always suspect, is because it was undeveloped capacity. We just said, tell us what's going on inside of you. And because people couldn't see, they were in what I was talking about earlier, a reactive mode. They thought that was real. And they would describe what they were doing reactively, replaying something in their head that was very upsetting as though it were full truth, or their ego trying to justify and position. And so these ideas that came out of the behavioral era and throughout the building of capacity for self-reflection and self-management are what we sorely need. And those two are built in mythologically into this particular study.
We'll be right back. I want to remind everyone about how to participate in the show by joining in our quiz on SurveyMonkey each week. This is where you can offer articles for review from HBR or other popular business written media. Find the link at businesssecondopinion.com. It's more fun to listen when you can participate. To get educated about Carol's approach to critiquing popular ideas, download her chapter at businesssecondopinion.com. Plus, there's a weekly drawing for a free copy of Carol's new book, Through a Generative Business. For all those who participate in the quiz, write comments, article recommendations, you will qualify to be in the drawing. For this next part, I wanted to dig in and see, I mean, you started to kind of talk about where the authors start to fall short in your view about how they considered the options based on the background you provide. Is there anything else here that you wanted to kind of flesh out?
I think that the thing that's really missing is that they are talking about in an article trying to teach one person how to manage a situation which is volatile with the assumption that no one has really built the capability in those people. I mean, that's the foundation. And so going forward, the thing I think is important for us to talk about and what I'm going to try and put in the blog about this is much more about what we have to build in individuals so we can have the capacity in the situation where it is and not keep bringing in these third-party ideas.
Mm-hmm. And so how would you approach this? What might you offer as kind of an alternative, or probably a number of things you would offer here, but let's start to walk through what those would look like.
Well, I guess first what I would say is if you want to build a regenerative business, you set up a process where people are ongoing in development. I know I've mentioned before that I build my work off some research that was done at Harvard years ago that said you have to be working with people in a new way of working weekly. You have to do that about 10% of their waking hours. And it takes many years to actually change the way people can think and work. It's almost not quite the 7 years it takes for cells to regrow. But I would instill and develop an ongoing practice like we did in Seventh Generation, where we met weekly with almost 100% of the people in the organization and developing their capacity to build shared frameworks and shared language, not shared thinking, because the ideas they had then became much wider and more open, but also to build a personal mastery. So you have to put that in place where you're building the capacity to see how you're thinking and see your own personal capability. In the book, I talk about what are I call the three foundational or core human capacities that we need to build. And then these conflicts would not look like conflicts. They would look like gaps in connections where we need to build something. And one of those, which might be really worth sharing here, is building the capacity for external considering. The way I came to learn about external considering when I was 4, 5, and 6 years old from my grandmother, and she was a very religious woman. She went to church probably 5 or 6 times a week, and she was constantly trying to teach me the golden rule. And one of the things she would do is fuss at me whenever I was being inconsiderate, and she would say, "Don't you ever consider anyone else besides yourself." And as I grew up and I started reading philosophy and psychology and spending a lot of time trying to find the history of these. What was the thread? Where did they come from? I found a concept in the Aramaic philosophers' traditions, which was called external considering. And external considering meant literally what my grandmother was trying to teach me. How it is you think about others, except in my work, it's become much more specific now. Oh, and then the opposite of that is how I get away from having it all be about me and having be all internal considering. So I'm only worried about the effect of everything on me, which is where the conflict comes from. I'm worried I'm going to lose ground. I'm attached to something I need. So I've proposed that this is one of the things I think we need to be bringing into organizations, which is this idea of external considering, moving from just being kind, which is great. If you are giving money to a homeless person, that's fine. I'm not talking about not being kind or saying thank you or giving your seat or, you know, how are you? I mean, all of those things are being kind, but it's not enough because it wouldn't let you know what to do with this conflict. The next level up of external considering, my grandmother would have loved this. I wish I could tell her. The next level up would be empathy, where I can actually feel your pain because I've been there, or at least I can image it if I've been alive long enough. That's a lot more than being kind, but some people can't quite go there, and some people can get stuck there with feeling empathy. On the other hand, it's not enough to actually help get past what we feel conflicted about. If you've read or know much about the saints, they often are given sainthood like Mother Teresa because she had compassion. It was more than empathy and I can feel your pain to, I actually not only feel your pain, I want to relieve your pain. I want to help make that go away. So just think about it. If in a conflict, you're watching someone and you're thinking, I can see this person is in pain. I now feel like I want to move to compassion to help relieve your pain. And in theory, we could do that without trading off ourselves completely. But I recommend a fourth level of external considering, which if you think about having these conflicted conversations from, it completely changes it. And that is from the level of caring. And caring means I want you to have the capacity. I want to evolve and build and develop your capacity and my own to be able to be self-managing in any conversation we have so it doesn't escalate, and to be able to de-escalate if we can see it happen, and even to de-escalate between nations, to de-escalate between kids in a neighborhood. Caring is about not just stopping it with compassion, but giving people the capacity themselves. Now, the mediator might be at the compassion level. There would be no mediator in caring because it would always be about starting to build. So if I'm a manager, like they're talking about going and being a mediator, I'd say, no, I don't say I don't have time to do this. This is a core capability of my organization to build the ability to be self-managing in regard to how much they care for and having the capacity to build people's capability so they can have these conversations. That's the thing that drove me most crazy about trying to read this article was this continuing set of steps for somebody else to steal that opportunity for evolving capacity.
So I want to actually ask here, so from the perspective of a manager or someone at the executive level, I can see what it is that you're talking about here, but if you could offer us a hint about how we would even begin to work on that, that would be helpful because I can see the value in that, but I don't even know where to begin to start to work on that in myself.
Right. So it isn't a doing again. It is a building capacity. And we always think of organizations and people always ask me, well, what do I do? And I said, first, you work on getting the mind that can think about this. And not only for you, but for everybody in your organization, you have to break loose of the attachment that you just need to do something different. You need to set up a process that says, we're going to back up and we are going to look at how we build capability. And that will change what we do. What we do is driven by what we're thinking and the subjects we can think about, but also how we're thinking. So all the stories you will read in my books, all the blogs I write about the transformations of companies, none of those I was a consultant and carried in a program. I didn't mediate. I didn't teach them how to mediate. I didn't teach them how to do conflict resolution. I introduced, and that's what you need to do, and everyone who is listening to this podcast needs to find a way to introduce an education, ongoing development process, preferably monthly, where they're working 10% of people's waking hours over a series of years, because otherwise 3 years, 5 years, 10 years from now, you'll be in the same place. So start now in developing the capacity to be able to see how you think and how it is your inner thinking and emotions work and how you can be managing in regard to them. Sorry to be so confronting, but that's what you need.
No, I appreciate it. I totally appreciate it. This is reminiscent of the book, I think. So I think there's two other aspects to this framework, if I remember from the book. So what are the other two aspects here?
So external considering certainly is the one I just talked about. There's internal locus of control. So in that case, or external. External locus of control is when I become the victim and I blame the other person. Now, you can see that in so much detail in conflict. Because the minute this third-party mediator goes in, what he or she is going to hear is, he did this, he did that, I was doing my thing, I was taking responsibility, and the other person is doing the same thing. Internal locus of control is people standing in their own clarity about even the way they respond to things is creating the ecosystem they're in, creating the reactions they get. So that's a part of building capability, and it's their first leg of the triad. Second is external considering. The third leg in that triad is personal agency, where I know that I need to step up, and when I see something needs doing, I need to take it on. And particularly the personal agency comes from being able to connect what I call my essence, who I am, what I stand for, was something that needs doing, that is worth doing, that is maybe even risky. And I'm going to promise to learn how to do that because it's probably beyond what I can do right now. But that's the way the world changes, and it's the way I go from being in the world to becoming in the world is to exercise agency to bring about something that needs bringing about for a customer, for a community, for a group of children, for wherever it is. Like in South Africa, we went after serving children. You can, wherever it is, make a promise to go do something and exercise personal agency to make that happen. That changes conflict. Conflict just kind of disappears because you got a bigger world you're looking at things from.
Mm-hmm. And so in terms of internal locus of control, I hear what you're saying there. How would I begin to approach or work on that?
Well, again, it's not something you can work on directly. It's not a capability building. It is a process of teaching people to be able to watch their modes of behavior. So you have the reactive ego purposeful. I'll just stick with that since I started here. So you're building people's capacity to reflect on when they're in reactive, because that's when the external locus of control happens and I start blaming other people. So you would be in one of your monthly education classes. No, not one, every one of your monthly education classes, you're introducing some process that gives people capability to be self-reflective based on a framework like, when am I reactive? And sometimes there's a good cause for being reactive, but it's usually like when a theater's burning down or a child is about to get run over. Most of the time we are reactive with one another just because we have an attachment to what they said and we don't like it. So the way you work on it is you start to build the capacity of people to see that for themselves. You never structure something where people see it for them and give them feedback. You do the same thing around ego. What does it look like when I am being attached to my ego and how things should come out and how I learn to manage that and how can I be reflective? What do the processes look like? And groups do that over and over and over. They're constantly being reflective on what's going on inside of them. Not having someone else give you feedback on where your ego got in the way, that undermines both of those processes. So the more someone else tells you how you're doing, the less internal locus of control you'll have, and the more you will think all of that has to come from outside of you, this third-party process.
Thank you so much for your time today, Carol.
My pleasure.
Do you want to suggest articles for Carol to review, pose questions for her to answer, or argue with her response and get a second opinion? Become a member at www.businesssecondopinion.com. Subscribe and review this podcast and get put in a drawing to win a copy of Carol's new book or a poster of readers' favorite quotes from the book. Also subscribe to the blog that accompanies the podcast and newsletter that keeps you up to date on what's coming next. This has been Business Second Opinion.